AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, all my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And, hey, guys, I got a question for both of you. Have you ever been on an airplane?
Yes.
I have also.
As a matter of fact.
In fact, Lauren, you've sat next to me on an airplane, so I knew that answer already for you.
You did. You're either very forgetful or asking a hypothetical question or just set up a deeper conversation.
Yes, it was a rhetorical device. I admit I am not above such things. We wanted to talk about the future of air travel in this episode and kind of talk about, you know, why is air travel even something that we're thinking about? Why? What's important about it? And what are the various barriers to making it, you know, more awesome.
More awesome. Yeah. I might be different than both of you in that I straight up hate air travel.
Oh, like, yeah?
I don't hate it so much that I refuse to get on a plane like some of those people. I mean, right. We know some around here who
just will not.
We've got a couple of people who work at HealthStuffWorks who have phobias that they deal with.
No judgment about that. You
sure.
Know, that's very understandable because I almost share it. I just very much dislike it. It's kind of like, you know, asking me if I would ride in the trunk of a car if it was my only option to get to where I needed to go. I mean, I guess I would do it.
But you wouldn't be happy.
But you really wouldn't be excited about it.
I am fine with air travel. I have no problem with it whatsoever. I can find flying on an airplane to be relaxing. I can fall asleep before we end up taxiing for takeoff.
Oh,
but,
wow.
But on the other hand.
I'm not that comfortable on planes.
On the other hand, I hate everything else about it. Like, the most stressful thing for me is just getting to the point where I'm at my gate. Mm-hmm. That's actually the most stressful part.
Sure. Well, with security checks these days and all
and
that.
And the fact that in the Atlanta airport, you have to travel approximately 47 miles before you ever get to the gate that you need to get to.
Yeah.
That also helps.
Yeah. The non-Euclidean design of airports certainly doesn't help.
Yeah.
Though there's a wonderful comedy factor to the narration of the between terminal train.
Oh, the plane train is what it's called now. And I wish I were making that up.
There's some great voice acting.
Actually, but I'll have to play for you guys. My wife found a sound clip of the old plane train, which was, in the early days of the Atlanta airport, voiced by apparently a Cylon from the original Battlestar Galactica series. It had that kind of robotic voice, be like, by your command, we're not moving to Concourse B. It didn't do the by your command part, but you get my point. Anyway, you know, there are some problems with air travel, even on a perfect flight, right?
I mean, not just our biases, but they're sort of actual problems.
Yeah, we've gotten to a point where, I mean, it's still amazing to think that we're able to travel anywhere in the world within, you know, a fraction of the time it would have taken a century ago.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously that is amazing.
Yeah, you can get to the opposite side of the globe within about 12 hours of travel.
Which is, again, like unthinkable. I mean, earlier generations would have thought this was amazing that we can travel from one point to another so relatively quickly. But, I mean, there's still improvements to be had. In fact, if you look at some of commercial air flight, we're not traveling as quickly as some aircraft used to travel. So we wanted to look at the future of air travel and kind of look at it. Well, everything from can we get to point A to point B, from point A to point B faster, and how much fuel are we using? What is the environmental impact of that? Is there any way of making aircraft more efficient so that we don't use as much fuel? Obviously, energy is always something we're thinking about here on this podcast, right?
Uh-huh.
Because our needs for energy are just going to continue to rise over time, and so we have to be smarter about the ways we end up getting at energy.
Well, okay, let's start with energy. I'm no physicist, but
right,
obviously,
clearly,
but you're a professional talker.
That it takes a lot more energy to move something through the air than to move that same amount of mass just along the ground.
In general, yeah.
I mean, without it falling through the air.
Although this is part of why airplanes are so keen these days on getting as many people as is physically possible crammed into a single airplane, because it becomes a lot more efficient the more people you are conveying from one place to another.
Yeah, mm-hmm. From a cost perspective, you think of it as the number of miles per passenger. Like it's
right. I mean, you know, if you're thinking about it, a plane might burn like a gallon of fuel every second.
That's a lot of fuel.
Which is a whole bunch of fuel. But if you even that out to about 500 passengers, that's really, you're getting like 100 miles to the gallon.
Right. Yeah. So it's a little different from looking at a car. You know, in a car, we tend to just think of how far can this car go on a full tank of gas. Like that tends to be the way we think about mileage, in as far as regular car vehicle type stuff goes. But if you're talking about aircraft, then we start looking at, well, how many people can it carry from its point of origin to its destination, and how much fuel is it burning? And then you kind of figure out the efficiency based on both of those things, not just how much fuel did it burn, but how many people was it able to carry.
Right. And there's more complications. Basically, all of this is really complicated to discuss because planes don't use the same fuel that cars do.
Right.
And so all of the emissions are going to be different, and your efficiency is going to vary widely based on different aircraft. Also, as it turns out, guys, chemical companies aren't really excited about publicizing their proprietary formulas. I don't know if you've ever heard about this, but they're a little bit secretive about their secret formulas.
I've been familiar with this ever since my first trip to KFC when I discovered that proprietary secrets are something they take very seriously. When I sit there and I say, I've identified 7 out of your 11 secret herbs and spices, and then they just escorted me from the building.
The ski masks came out of the kitchen.
It got ugly. And as it turns out, the people in the aircraft industry are almost as intense about it. So,
yeah, I imagine they're not super forthcoming about, say, like exactly what the fuel efficiency standards of their vehicles are, and
exactly what kind of emissions come out of it as a result.
And you can check out. There's a few governmental websites that'll talk a little bit about really, really basic concepts of averages across standards.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you can look it up and say that a jet fuel emits some 9.6 kilograms of carbon dioxide per gallon burned.
Wow. So then you have to extrapolate that by how many gallons are burned on a typical flight, and then figure out how many flights are there on a typical day. And yeah, this gets complicated. And also, not only that, but I mean, aircraft can burn different amounts of fuel depending upon how much weight they're carrying.
Oh, absolutely. And how long the distance is, how long they spend at an optimum speed versus the takeoff and landing,
right.
What the weather conditions are like. All sorts of stuff like that will go into that number. On an average comparison, your automobile is going to emit some 8.9 kilograms of carbon dioxide per gallon burned.
Right. And
so
it's burning fewer gallons.
Yes. But you're also not talking about the same kind of gasoline. Jet fuel is kerosene based. It's kerosene or naphtha. Plus some other hydrocarbons purified to remove various contaminants up to and including like water. As it turns out, crystals of ice are really bad if they get into your jet engine. And plus a few additives to prevent stuff like corrosion and static buildup. As opposed to autogas or mogas, which is the kind of aviation term for automobile fuel, which is, petroleum gasoline modified with some ethanol to burn cleaner.
Yeah, to increase the octane.
And another couple additives to prevent a couple things.
Okay, but jet fuel emissions, we're not just talking about like a carbon problem, right? There's some other contaminants, right?
There's a bunch of stuff like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides that wind up in jet fuel emissions. And a study out of MIT just recently found that it's pretty toxic stuff. They were looking at flight paths and weather patterns and premature deaths in various areas that have roots in air pollution. You're talking about deaths, with cardiovascular or respiratory problems, lung cancer, stuff like that. And jet plane emissions can kill about 10,000 people every year.
Wow. Wow. According to
MIT. Just looking at the way that these areas of increased risk of death from cardiovascular, from air pollution related causes are turning up 10,000 deaths per year in areas that receive a high concentration of jet fuel emission.
Man.
And for the record, ships are a lot worse and can cause as many as 60,000 people to die every year. And I did not find a number on cars, so that is completely unhelpful. But that's a lot. And some of this might be impacted by something as simple as regulatory measures like filtering out sulfur, which could cost as little as 5 cents a gallon, according to some researchers.
Yeah. So keeping in mind that these aircraft have hundreds of gallons of gas, but still,
yes,
and when you compare that to deaths, it's still cheap.
Yeah, if you could save people from dying from the inhalation of particulates and the development of these deadly diseases, then that's...
Yeah, and you brought up something else I just want to address really quickly before we move on, mm-hmm. which is that the idea that there are other vehicles that also create harmful emissions that can contribute to health hazards and even contribute to someone dying earlier than what they normally would have. We totally understand that. We do understand there are other vehicles that do this.
Oh, yeah.
But that you can't say because these other things do this, then this isn't a problem. Clearly, it's a problem that we need to look at across multiple types of vehicles. So
we're focusing today on aircraft,
right?
Because we could go on for a very long time about many different kinds of travel, and probably will in future episodes.
Yes, exactly. So I just wanted to bring that up so that we don't get the people who respond with, well, if vehicles contribute to X number and aircraft are only X number, then why are you saying let's fix, you know, just the aircraft at the expense of vehicles? That's not what we're saying.
Sure. Also, air travel is on the rise. In the United States, it saw I don't have the number in front of me, but I remember seeing like a 1.3% increase from 2011 to 2012, you know, which over the course of several years worldwide, that was just in the U.S., could be pretty significant.
Mm.
And noise pollution is a thing, too, with aircraft. A couple studies published in the British Medical Journal in October of 2013, we are recording this podcast in November of 2013, found that people who lived with higher levels of aircraft noise, a.k.a. closer to airports, had increased risks of stroke and other cardiovascular diseases. And that's after adjustment for stuff like socioeconomic status and demographic factors, air pollution, closeness to roadways. And, you know, we talked a little bit about noise pollution in our wind turbine episode. So if you guys want to go back and listen to that one, but basically noise pollution of any kind can cause stress and sleep disturbance through this kind of nasty self-perpetuating cycle of what's called annoyance, and is actually more serious than it sounds when you just say it
right.
I'm annoyed.
Right.
But it's, it can lead to chronic stress, which is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, which we've talked about also in previous podcasts about how stress can really impact your quality and length of life, as it turns out. So, you know, these are all things that we could look at to say, well, the future of air travel needs to address certain things, like how efficient the aircraft are, how quickly they travel, how much noise they produce, how many types of emissions do they emit? Can we limit that? And some of these questions are really complicated already, and then you complicate them more by saying, well, what's the best approach? Because obviously we don't have a magic solution to addressing all of these issues at once. Some of them you're going to have to weigh against others and decide what's the most important. But let's talk about some of the proposals we've seen for making aircraft more efficient.
Some groups, for example, NASA, have started to get heads together basically and say, well, let's look at aircraft design and see what we can do to actually fix these problems instead of just, you know, worrying about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Didn't they put together a whole report on outlining some good future guidelines for how to get planes to be safer and awesomer?
In 2009, NASA's Aeronautics Research Mission Directorate's Integrated Systems Research Program.
Does that not have like an acronym?
I bet that has.
ISRP.
See, that's perfect. Rolls off the tongue.
NASA Armed ISRP.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
All right,
perfect. NASA.
They released the Environmentally Responsible Aviation Project. And this basically, it was to challenge people to come up with new aircraft configurations that they could deploy by 2025.
And oh, wow, that's soon.
They've got and right now on their website, they've got a list of goals that include reducing aircraft drag by 8%, reducing aircraft weight by 10%, reducing specific fuel consumption of aircraft engines by 15%, reducing oxides of nitrogen emissions by 75%.
Oh,
that's
wow.
A big one. That's very ambitious,
and,
obviously.
Reducing aircraft noise by 1/8 compared to current standards. And I think those were based on aircraft as they were measured in 1998. But that's, I think, not a whole lot different than now, because a lot of the aircraft that are in service have been around for a long time.
For
sure.
Several
decades. Even the ones that have been constructed, you know, relatively recently, were in the engineering planning department for years before they were ever, you know, unveiled to the public. So, you know, even if you were to say, oh, but the such and such plane only came out in 2004, so clearly it's, well, there's chances that
it
the
probably,
plans
it probably
date
had to
way
have gone
back.
Through at least 10 years of,
yeah.
of testing.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I wanted to talk about a few things, ideas I've seen in conjunction with the response to this project. And some of these are aerodynamic redesigns to the body of airplanes, because it turns out this matters a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just your engine, but it's dealing with this thing, the drag coefficient.
Right.
The,
right.
The resistance that your plane is experiencing as it's flying. And I guess you're also trying to increase the lift to drag ratio.
Right.
To lower the amount of energy you need and therefore probably also the emissions you create
sure.
when you're flying through the air.
Right. Your engines don't have to work as hard if the drag is lowered.
Yeah. And so one of the cool things I saw was the idea of the boxed wing or the closed wing system. Have you ever seen this?
No.
I've not seen pictures of it. I read a little bit about it and it basically made my mind go, rawr, and
yeah.
run away.
It's on one hand, it seems really simple. It's so normally you imagine a plane body like a passenger jet, a Boeing, you know, it's got wings sticking out. Well, apparently when a plane is flying through the air at its maximum efficiency, you know, high speed, there is this phenomenon known as wingtip vortices.
Mm-hmm.
So at the ends of the wings, there's this turbulent spiraling of air
mm-hmm.
that creates drag on the airplane as it's moving through. Because in general, turbulence is bad.
Right.
Right.
And so one idea is that you have these things called winglets, wingtip devices, mm-hmm. and they try to cut down on wingtip vortices by, you've probably seen something like this before. Instead of just the wings ending, they've got like little flappy tab that flips
yeah.
up on mm-hmm. the end. And so that helps cut down on that some, but it's still there. Well, what if you, sort of extend that idea and just keep those winglets coming up until they come all the way around and form a closed loop system of wings? Well, apparently Lockheed Martin offered a design like this in response to the ERA program.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so it looks, I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it looks like it's got a boxy wing. Other people throughout history have tried to do this with, like, say, loop wings, like ring wings. They come out and they're sort of a circle around the plane.
Mm-hmm.
This would be one that, like modern passenger planes, the wings are built right into the fuselage. So
okay.
It's not like a loop around the fuselage, but I don't know if that's feasible for any reason or not.
All right, so that's what Lockheed's been working on. What other designs are out there?
Well, there's here's one. You ever seen a B-2 bomber?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so there's this thing about it. It's kind of different than the body of most passenger planes in that most of them have this kind of you know, cucumber tube in the middle and then
wings
sticking
coming
out.
Off, yeah, whereas a B-2 is what's referred to as a flying wing.
Yeah, it's a flying wing design, so the whole thing is a wing.
Right.
And why does that help? Well, the wings are the part of the plane that gives you lift.
Uh-huh.
Because a plane stays in the air essentially by throwing air down off the bottom of it. So as it moves through the air very quickly, it's throwing air downward, and this lifts the body of the plane up. Now, the more flat surface you have along the bottom of the plane to sort of get the oncoming air to rush under, the more lift you have. And so a flying wing design helps give you a better lift-to-drag ratio. Now, apparently there are a lot of difficulties with a design like this. Like, it might be harder to make the plane stable. But, of course, we got some smart people out there who are aeronautics
yeah.
engineers. And the thought is, if you could create a passenger plane that had a fuselage built into the wing design instead of mm-hmm. separately, that would also help increase efficiency. A similar plan to this is a sort of what's been called a blended wing design, which is sort of like somewhere in the middle between what a modern passenger plane looks like today and that flying wing, totally flat design, where there's sort of a still a separate fuselage, but it's more evenly
integrated.
Built into the wing.
Okay.
So those are some new body designs, but also there are a lot of things just about the more specific individual parts of the plane that can help improve efficiency while it's in mid-flight. For example, one thing is what I've read about is called hybrid laminar flow control.
Mm-hmm.
So when air moves over a plane, when anything's moving through a fluid,
mm-hmm.
there are two different ways that the fluid outside, like air or liquid or whatever, can move over the vehicle. And it can move over it in turbulent flow, which usually happens at higher speeds, and that means it's getting all churned up and it's moving in a lateral direction Or it can move in laminar flow, which is sort of like smooth parallel motion. And so when you're rushing through air, the air that flows over you is going to be, I guess, smooth when you first encounter it. But as it moves along the surface at high speeds, it's more likely to become turbulent.
Okay.
But laminar flow control on the outside of a plane is designing the surface of the plane to try to reduce this, to make the airflow over the plane as smooth as possible for as long as possible.
So does this have to do with materials science, figuring out the best materials to create this laminar flow?
It could, but it also could just have to do with, like, designing the skin of the airplane. Like, you could, apparently designing it with holes placed in certain places can allow suction of air down through that offsets some of this, like, outward spiraling of air that creates the turbulence.
Oh, cool.
And in any case, I know this is complicated engineer stuff, but basically what it is it's designing the skin of an airplane to make it flow more smoothly.
Awesome.
Okay, so we've got all these things like that, and these redesigns could help increase the efficiency of airplanes during flight. Another one might just be like, surely you can boost your lift-to-drag ratio if you just make bigger wings, right?
Sure.
But there are also some limits on that, because the bigger your wings are, the stronger you have to make them, and then that adds weight. So there is some optimalization
of weight to size.
Wing size,
yeah.
Well, not only that, but, I mean, there's a practical issue too, right?
Right. So a problem with a lot of these, actually, I talked to a friend of mine who studied aerospace engineering at Georgia Tech, and I was talking to him about this episode, and he pointed out something interesting, which is just that it might be a problem implementing these designs simply because they might be harder to put into operational capacity within existing airports.
Right.
It might be hard to get them up to airport gates.
I mean,
wow.
That sounds so, you know, banal as an objection, but
it's totally practical,
yeah, no.
Though. I mean, like, okay, so I travel fairly frequently, and I travel on lots of different types of aircraft. And some of the larger aircraft at the Atlanta airport, you realize that if you're going to certain destinations, you're almost always going to have to walk to the very end of the concourse, which, as we said earlier, is approximately 47 miles long. And so that's you know, you just know it if you're going to certain destinations, because those destinations tend to use certain types of aircraft. Like, if I go to Las Vegas or Orlando, I know I'm going to have a long walk ahead of me they're using larger aircraft for both of those because they're both high traffic destinations. Atlanta, of course, is a big hub city for air travel. So for anything that's a high profile destination that a lot of people are going to and they're changing through in Atlanta, those aircraft tend to be larger to take as many people as possible. The larger aircraft do not fit into the gate areas that are closer into the middle of the concourse, where it would be the most convenient for the passenger who's just stepping off the train and wants to get on the plane. They fit at the ends of the concourse. That's where they have a little more space for those. So if we're talking about changing the design of planes so radically it changes the actual profile of the planes, then that becomes a problem. We've got all this existing infrastructure, which has been built over decades and cost billions of dollars collectively. Just for like a single city, it could be billions of dollars. And then you multiply that at all the cities around the world that have you know, international airports or large domestic airports. This is a huge challenge. You know, I won't go so far as to say it's a problem, but it's certainly a challenge. Now, one way of addressing that challenge is to completely rethink the way that we have people get on and off of aircraft. I mean, I don't know about either of you. Have either of you ever flown into an airport where you got off the aircraft onto a set of stairs onto the tarmac?
I've deplaned onto a tarmac.
Yeah, me too.
But only, so, I think it was like once, and I felt like I was someone fancy in the 1960s when I did it.
Yeah,
I did it when I was flying to a very small airport, not a very large one, because we had to get on a little plane that was like made out of cellophane to fly to the Possum Mountain Airport.
Not tall enough to sit at the big boy table with all the other planes, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of thing. Like, if you're talking about planes that can't fit into the existing infrastructure, we may be looking at doing that sort of thing. That might be a practical approach, a practical answer to that problem, as opposed to...
Rather than building entirely new airports or entirely new wings on existing airports.
Or, yeah, or just saying, well, this entire concourse is going to go down for renovation and we're going to have half the right. number of gates that we had.
Yeah, there's another cost obstacle, which is simply that airplanes are mega expensive and they're usually designed, I think, to work for a while.
Yes. You know?
So yeah. The airplanes that are already out there, nobody's in a hurry to retire them.
Right.
Certainly not. And some of the basic designs that we're using today have been in use for 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and you look at it again, like even going into the point of prototyping a design, testing it, making sure it's safe, making sure it actually is doing the things you intended it to do, because sometimes people design stuff and when they test it out, they realize that it's not as efficient as they thought,
right.
or maybe it's even less efficient than conventional aircraft already are. You have to test all of that, and then once all that is done, assuming it works, you still have to go into manufacturing. All of this is...
Costly,
and it takes a long, long time.
All that aside, I am excited about these aerodynamic redesigns, and I hope that some can be tested and found to be useful and actually put into practice. But I had another idea. So all that was about just body design,
yeah.
aerodynamic redesign. I mean, what about the engines themselves, the part of the plane that does the flying?
Well, sit yourself down, Joe. I got a tale to tell you.
Yeah, you got something about the future of
I got a couple things.
Big aeroplane engines.
Well, I'll start this off by telling you a little story about how stuff works.
Okay.
So, how stuff works, that's the office we work in.
Uh-huh.
And we used to do this thing every year where we would write an April Fool's article to go on How Stuff Works that was just a joke. And it was just one article out of the hundreds of articles on the site. And one year, my former editor, Chris Paulette, wrote about a new version of Air Force One that was going to be launched that year that was a hybrid airplane. And he wrote about the fuel cells that were on the plane and how many batteries there were and the fact that it added so much weight to the plane that it required even more batteries to, you know, it was just sort of a joke that was all about how difficult this problem was. And, you know, it was a funny little joke, and it went on the website and did well and great. Now we got people who are working on building hybrid airplanes, and not just an airplane that can carry a single passenger. We're talking about the application for potentially commercial jets.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Hybrid, I assume you mean a combination of, like, gas turbine and electric?
Well, jet fuel turbine and electric, yes.
Yeah.
So, for example, one of the ones is, and this is merely in the concept phase. This is not even prototype phase, but
right.
Boeing's Sugar Volt. So Sugar is an acronym. Sugar stands for Subsonic Ultra Green Aircraft Research.
So you don't just give it candy bars and let it get really excited?
No, you give it little bitty kisses.
Okay.
Give you some sugar.
Butterfly kisses.
So this was one of the things that came out, one of the projects that came out of those discussions at NASA.
Uh-huh.
NASA sort of approached an entire team, and it was led by Boeing, to look into how feasible would it be to create some form of hybrid commercial jet. And so it's very similar in a way to electric cars, you know, or hybrid cars, really, the kind of cars that use gasoline for some features and then switch over to electric. Same basic idea. So anything that would require a great deal of power to operate, so anything like takeoffs, you know, that takes a lot of power mm-hmm. to get an aircraft into the air,
mm-hmm.
that would still rely on conventional fuels for aircraft. But then once you got into a cruising speed, the idea would be to switch over to electric motors as opposed to jet fuel engines and continue to operate using the electric power source. And the idea would be that you would have batteries that would provide the electricity. Ultimately, Boeing says this would allow you to design aircraft that would consume 70% less fuel on a typical flight than compared to today's conventional aircraft.
Whoa.
So that's a huge amount of savings, right? So the design of this aircraft went beyond, and again, it's a concept, but it went beyond just the hybrid nature of the power source, the engines and the motors. It also went toward the aircraft's wings, which were designed to create more lift and less drag, just like we've been saying, which would also allow the aircraft to take off earlier than other aircraft, thus also adding to those savings. Because if you're spinning,
you mean like earlier on the runway?
Earlier on the runway, yeah. It would take less time, let's say, or less distance, either way you want to put it, for them to take off. And again, the goal there is to get them to an altitude where they could switch over as quickly as possible so that you consume as little fuel as possible. And although the wings were designed to be very large, they were also designed to fold in on themselves so that you could, in theory, use existing infrastructure, thus getting rid of that practicality problem you were talking about.
You mean getting it up to the gate.
Yeah, exactly. Just to be able to use the existing airports that are already popular throughout the world. And the timeline they gave for such an aircraft to actually become reality, and as opposed to just a concept, would be sometime between 2030 and 2050, which sounds a lot like our standard rolling deadline.
Well, 20 to 50 years?
Yeah, by then we'll all reach a singularity. So
by then we'll be on
anyway.
Mars, according to Mars One. But that's not the only hybrid vehicle I can talk about. There's actually another one I really want to mention. And the reason I want to mention this is because, unlike the Sugar Volt, this one exists. Like, it's been built. And it's even undergone a test flight.
Like prototype phase?
On a passenger plane scale.
Not a passenger plane scale, but it is, it's a design that theoretically could be scaled up to commercial jet size.
Let's hear it.
Okay.
It's the DA-36 E-Star 2, which was a plane that, where the,
that's a really snazzy name.
Yeah. The engine was built by Siemens.
Okay.
And they created an electric series hybrid drive system. And, it's actually been built and it's been flown. This is a propeller based aircraft though, not a jet aircraft.
Okay.
So this is a hybrid plane. It uses both, fuel and electricity. They claim that it could be scaled up for commercial aircraft use. However, whereas the fuel savings on the Sugar Volt are predicted to be at around 70%, which is incredible, it's much more modest gains with the Star 2. We're talking about 25% gains.
Still
better, you're right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But again, not jet engine. It's got a electrically driven motor, propeller. So it can possibly be scaled up to aircraft that could carry between 50 to 100 passengers, depending upon the design. So not as large as...
So more like a puddle jumper than your regular, you know, 500-person
I'd say between
commercial.
A puddle jumper and, you know, your standard jet. So it all depends. Like, there are some aircraft out there that have around between 80 and 100 seats. So
sure.
It all depends upon the ones you're looking at. It's certainly not nearly as large as something like a 747, which can carry more than 200
like
passengers.
Like 558 people, I think.
If you stack them horizontally, you can fit one more in there. And beyond that, there's one other person who has talked about the possibility of a fully electric supersonic jet. Can you guess who would be interested in building a supersonic jet that's completely electric? It's someone that we've talked about before. I'll give you a hint. He's interested in space and electric vehicle. No.
Elon Musk?
Elon Musk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We're talking Tesla and SpaceX guy. So Elon Musk said he has some interest in looking into designing such a vehicle. Not that he has started to have a concept or anything, just that was one thing that a challenge he would like to try and meet at some point. Now, keep in mind that Musk has got a lot of stuff on his plate already, including Tesla, SpaceX, and the Hyperloop.
Right.
So, although technically the Hyperloop's not on his plate, it was something.
He's more of an idea, man.
Yeah. I think, and so I don't know how likely it is that he or his engineering team are ever going to seriously look into this. It would be really remarkable to build a fully electric supersonic jet.
Yeah.
I mean, creating an electric motor capable of getting an aircraft into the air, let alone going supersonic speeds, is pretty hard.
Well, yeah, I'd have to imagine there are so many challenges to that. Now, my guess would be that the huge problem is the batteries.
That would be enormous.
Where do you store all this energy?
Right.
Right. And that was going to be my question for that savings of 70% of the normal energy that we would use that you were talking about with the Sugar Volt.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, batteries aren't charged with magic, they're also charged with energy. And,
right. Well, 70% of fuel.
Of fuel
is what it would be. Not.
Well, yeah. And that's what I meant to say, and not what I physically said. but I mean, you know, it brings us back to that common argument that we make about, like, well, even if you are plugging something into a wall socket, that's not
free
energy.
Where's the electricity coming from?
Right, it's still coming from somewhere.
Right, so if that electricity is coming from a coal plant that's right down the road,
fuel is being burned one way or another.
Yeah, it's just, it's different kind of fuel, different kind of emissions, but it's still something that you have to think about. Whereas if that electricity is coming from a solar farm or a wind farm or some dude pedaling a bicycle really fast in the back of the airport, you know, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Joe's like, no, man, that guy pedaling that bike is just like a coal plant. Oh, you're a tough man, Joe. All right. So, but you know, I wanted to talk about something besides just electric and hybrid vehicles too. All right. So we've talked about the hybrids, the idea of electricity and jet fuel. We've talked about the pie in the sky electric vehicle that has no parameters around it, other than the fact that Elon Musk said one other thing. He wanted it to be a vertical takeoff and landing vehicle.
What?
Yeah.
Why don't you just add another impossible thing?
And
I mean,
the only
the
person who
thing
can
to
pilot
do anyway.
It is Nick Fury. So.
It's going to be the size of an aircraft carrier. Yeah, no, he wants a jet that could take off vertically and land vertically, meaning that, you know, you wouldn't need an airstrip. You could just take off straight from wherever you were.
Yeah, but even the planes that are capable of vertical takeoff and landing, like say the Harrier jump jet or the V2 Osprey, they don't like to do that.
No.
Right.
You want
it's
to avoid it at all
preferred,
costs.
Preferred, yeah.
But this is that, you know, Musk is like go big or go home though. So, but the other thing I wanted to talk about was the solar impulse. You guys have heard about this, right? The solar powered airplane.
Yeah.
So solar powered aircraft. It's one of those things that when you first hear it, you think, well, that's crazy.
Well, you think there's a catch. They're like, okay, so they used gas to get up in the air or something.
No.
This is a solar powered airplane.
It's a solar powered aircraft.
It's pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome. Once I start describing it, you're going to realize, oh, that's pretty awesome, but not practical. So it's a one seater plane. So there's
strike one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cause I mean, obviously if you're going to have something that's using solar power, you are limited by how much energy you can get at any given time. Even if you have batteries on this thing, the batteries can only supply so much energy.
Let's be clear to not downplay this achievement. This is not just something that we're talking about as a concept. The solar impulse has completed a flight across the United States in stages. But.
Right. And the plan is to have it fly all the way around the globe, by 2015.
Yeah.
So it exists, and it's an incredible achievement. It's just one of those things where you realize that while this is an incredible achievement, it also kind of illustrates the problem of things like the efficiency of solar panels, as well as trying to come up with a design for an aircraft that is truly efficient and is not emitting any greenhouse gases.
So what you're saying is you don't think the solar impulse means that there's ever going to be a solar-powered passenger plane.
Well, let me give you a few more examples of what this thing does.
Okay. All right.
So it's a one-seater plane, and part of that is to really control exactly how much weight this aircraft has, because weight is one of those really important things about, you know, the more weight you have, the more power you need to get that thing going through the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a really large wingspan to try and maximize lift, and it also, the design is there to minimize drag, mm-hmm. just like we've been talking about.
That also gives it a little bit more surface area for solar panels.
Yeah, it's got more than 11,000 solar panels on it.
Wow.
Yeah. This, by the way, is giving probably just enough electricity to fly it at regular cruising speed, maybe with a comfortable margin, but not a huge amount over that.
And with a plane that size, you're talking about a light sport craft, which is going to only be going a very small fraction of what a jet plane.
Oh. You want to know how fast this sucker goes?
I do.
Your car goes faster, Lauren.
Yes, actually, yeah, your car at idle can go. No, it's 43 miles per hour average flying speed, or 70 kilometers per hour.
Okay.
That's the average flying speed.
That's on the slow end for a light sport craft. Those can generally go up to, I guess, like Autobahn speeds, like maybe like 130 miles per hour, is what you're normally going to hit in one of those.
This thing flies so leisurely that you can get to where you're going faster in a car. It's got a maximum altitude of about 27,900 feet or 8,500 meters. And yeah, it just it flies by solar power and by battery, so that if it's overcast and you're not flying at an altitude high enough to be over the clouds. If it's overcast, your batteries can maintain flight, as well as if it's nighttime, you could still fly this thing. And in fact, that's important for a flight that's going to go around the globe. It's not always going to have full exposure to the sun.
Not unless you timed it extremely carefully.
Right. So you have to remember, like, these solar panels, yeah. Like, lots of stops, and you have lots of aircraft carriers between California and Asia. So, Joe, to your question, like, could this ever be a commercial aircraft? No. I mean, the limitations are just too great. Our efficiency for solar panels is pretty low. We're talking...
Right. It's, I think, really good for solar panels is usually, like, 20%
that's
efficiency.
That's right. Yeah, 20% efficiency is, like, in the field, that's considered a really good goalpost.
Right. And in the lab, we've gotten up to a blazing, like, 50% efficiency, and that's an extremely hypothetical situation.
Right. So. It's to a point where you would never see that ever.
Never.
And keep in mind, again, that's under ideal conditions. So 20% efficiency under ideal conditions, then you have other things that are not 100% efficient. I mean, your drivetrain is never going to be 100% efficient. I think that they calculated that out of all the potential energy this aircraft could, in theory, gather if everything worked perfectly, the actual amount of energy that goes into operating the plane is something like 12%.
Wow.
So... that means you've got a 12% efficiency ultimately for this aircraft, which is not great. And even if you were to increase the efficiency of the solar panels, you can only do that so much. And adding the extra weight and size of the aircraft would make it like the problem is that extra weight and size would rapidly go well beyond whatever extra capacity you had by bumping up that solar panel efficiency. So it does not look like it would ever be an effective way of creating a commercial jet aircraft.
Yeah, and even if it's really light, I don't imagine you could just keep making the wings infinitely longer.
No.
I mean, eventually you'd have some structural problems.
Yeah, you have some metal fatigue already with regular aircraft.
Sure.
And I read that apparently the solar impulse, when you factor in all the efficiency problems, is ultimately about as powerful as the Wright Brothers plane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you wouldn't expect to fly on a aircraft powered by the Wright Brothers engine that would allow you and 99 of your closest friends to hop on over to the Bahamas.
Yeah. At the same time, I just want to say once more that just because this thing doesn't do the thing we're asking about, it's still pretty amazing what it does do.
The fact that it was, you know, it's truly a feat in engineering. It's amazing that people were able to have it work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to take anything away from the people who worked
totally.
On the project.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just not a solution to commercial aircraft. That doesn't mean that it won't teach us lots of valuable things, right?
Yeah.
But
see, I've got a better idea, I think, actually, which is a wind-powered aircraft, because you've got all this wind coming at you when you're flying. If you just put some like wind turbines,
so right next to the jet engines.
Yeah.
So you got wind turbines.
Yeah.
People just look at it like, this is totally confusing me.
Well, I mean, technically, that's what supersonic planes use to ignite the fuel in their jet engines.
Scramjets. You know, that brings us to the concept of supersonic. I'm glad that we were able to segue seamlessly. Then I commented
supersonic,
on it.
That's dead, right?
No.
Not
entirely. I mean, for commercial jets right now, it's not. It's definitely not what people are looking at.
No, I don't mean for the military. I mean, like, like supersonic passenger jets. Is that just a thing of the past, or is there any future for that?
It's tough. All right. I think there's a future in the sense that there's certainly a desire for it from the consumer standpoint, right? I mean, if you are told...
you want to get there faster.
Right.
Yeah,
if you're told, like, well, if you fly on a standard aircraft, it's going to take you 8 hours to get from New York to London. But then you're told, or you could jump on this other aircraft and it's going to take you 3.5 hours.
The Concorde.
The Concorde. Of course there was the supersonic commercial jet, the Concorde. There were only 20 of them ever built, I believe. And, it was a premium customer aircraft, right? So, like, take the highest amount you would ever pay for a first class ticket and add about 20% to that ticket.
Oof.
That's how much your average ticket was for just a ride on the Concorde. It had a capacity of 100 passengers, and for a while it was operating at capacity. So it was fairly profitable for a while, but the aircraft suffered some major setbacks. For one, the economy of jet fuel began to change over time, and that began to impact the bottom line. For another, there was the terrible tragedy in Paris, where the Concorde was completely destroyed when it was, I think it was on takeoff, when it collided with something, and I think a piece of the jet broke off and ended up a catastrophic failure and absolute terrible tragedy. That impacted the entire industry, not just the Concorde, but the entire commercial airline industry. And then there were other things that happened that got the FAA and other organizations interested in making sure that aircraft were at certain levels of safety, and that would have meant retrofitting the entire fleet of Concordes, which would have cost millions of dollars. Ultimately, the Concorde program was shelved, but if you're curious how fast it could go, so your average commercial jet travels at a speed of around 500 miles per hour. All right, okay. That's average. Now
that's average cruising speed.
Average cruising speed,
which is different than say like takeoff speed.
Right, exactly.
Stuff like
yes, yeah. Average cruising speed is about 500 miles per hour, or 804 kilometers per hour. The Concorde traveled at Mach 2.02, which is about 1,350 miles per hour, or 2,170 kilometers per hour.
That's decadent.
Yeah, it took average travel time was 3.5 hours between New York and London, although.
Decadent, but awesome.
The fastest travel time between New York and London was 2 hours, 52 minutes, and 59 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of a proof of concept, see how fast you could get there. Now, these are supersonic. That means they go faster than the speed of sound.
Yeah, so I want to ask a few questions here.
Hit me.
I assume supersonic jets mean... correct me if I'm wrong, massive consumption of fuel.
Yeah. That's,
also, sonic booms.
Yes.
And both of these things are bad.
Well, I mean, depending upon whom you ask, if you are a person who sells jet fuel, you think it's awesome. But, no, in general, we consider both of these to be strikes against supersonic jets. So yes, the Concorde was a fuel-hungry aircraft. It consumed more fuel than your regular commercial jets would, to operate at that level. And because it had fewer passengers on the Concorde than, say, a 747 would, that...
You're not making back as much
right. We talked
efficiency.
About, we talked about the fuel efficiency being thought of in terms of how many passengers you get from point A to point B, plus the distance and everything else in between. If you look at that, the Concorde was something like... 17 miles per gallon of fuel per passenger, and the 747 was like 80. So that's a big difference. Like, yeah, you're going to get there faster, but it's much less efficient. It's going to cost a lot more in fuel. You're going to have a lot more emissions. On top
it's
of that.
It's like the Hummer of the skies.
Yeah. And then, now let's talk about sonic booms. All right. So sonic booms. Now, when you travel through the air and you're traveling at a good speed, you are creating these waves in front of you. All right. And as you start to travel faster, these waves get compressed more and more until you hit about, you know, when you break over the speed of sound, you have compressed these waves to a point where they cannot be compressed anymore. And that's where you get this sonic boom.
That's where you become Guile from Street Fighter.
Sonic boom! No. There's a common misconception that you get the sonic boom when the aircraft goes from subsonic to supersonic speeds. That's not true. When you get to supersonic speed, the sonic boom is going until you get out of supersonic speed. It's a rolling carpet of sonic booms. So,
which explains why you're going to hear it not only in the place where it originates, but also
anywhere along its path.
Anywhere along the path.
Yeah,
right.
If you are anywhere along the path of this aircraft while it's traveling at supersonic speeds, when it passes over, assuming there are multiple things that factor into this, but assuming the factors are right, you will hear the sonic boom. Those factors include everything from the speed of the aircraft, the size of the aircraft, how high up the aircraft is, how far away it is from you, because if it's not flying directly overhead, that's another difference, and the temperature of the air, as it turns out, because sound travels at different speeds depending upon the air's temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say Mach 1, we're talking about the speed of sound. That's not a standard speed. You know, you have to consider what the temperature of the air is. That will determine what the actual speed of sound is.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these different factors will determine whether or not you hear a sonic boom. However, you're probably going to hear some sonic booms if you happen to be along the pathway of a supersonic jet route. So people in certain villages in England who are along the path of the Concorde, they started seeing things like the windows in their houses would keep on vibrating whenever a jet was flying over. Sometimes the tiles on their roofs would come loose because these sonic booms were creating these concussive little blasts, and they'd build up over time. They weren't powerful enough to like shatter windows in a go.
Sure, but talk about annoyance.
That's a big one. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a problem. I also wanted to bring up the idea of hypersonic, because supersonic's just not fast enough, yo. But hypersonic, now I'm talking about this only so I can compare it against supersonic, because hypersonic are... these are aircraft that are not meant for commercial use at all. These are military use.
Super fancy military planes.
Sometimes scientific research, but none of it is for, you know, getting your
anywhere
boss.
Near commercial.
Yeah. You're not going to be hopping on this to go down to Disneyland. If you are, then you're an astronaut, apparently. But hypersonic, like the fastest hypersonic jet speed ever was Mach 20.
Oof.
So the Concorde went 2.02. The fastest jet to ever fly was Mach 20. Now, that was an unmanned aircraft.
Yeah, I was about to say.
That sounds uncomfortable.
13,000 miles per hour. Yeah, 13,000 miles per hour by an unmanned Falcon HTV-2, which, if it were to travel between New York and London, would make that trip in 12 minutes.
Oof.
Yeah, 12 minutes to get from New York to London. Now, this was an unmanned flight. This is a military flight that would be launched from another aircraft. Like the HTV-2 Falcon was one of those that you would have a secondary aircraft flying through the air. It would be launched from that. And then once you got to the right speed, because for scramjet engines to work, you already have to be going what is commonly referred to in the industry as wicked fast. And then once you reach wicked fast speed, you can initiate the scramjet engines.
Right. It's the same theory as the hybrid planes that you were talking about earlier, where you've got a conventional jet engine that's going to bring you up to speed.
Yep. So the fastest speed for manned flight, I hear you ask me, is...
let me guess. Is that SR-71 Blackbird?
Yes, it is the SR-71 Blackbird. Do you know when that record was set?
I'm going to guess the 70s.
That's pretty good. 1976.
Okay.
1976 was when the fastest manned flight was recorded, and that was in an SR-71 Blackbird, the successor, at least in theory, to the U-2 spy plane. It ultimately would not live longer than... we're still using the U-2. We're not still using the Blackbird. The Blackbird... top speed was 2,193 miles per hour, which could get between New York and London in a little over an hour and a half. If you were to fly it, that, again, obviously not a commercial jet. You're talking about a spy plane. If you're taking a spy plane to get from New York to London, you're clearly Archer and you live in a fantasy universe. The rest of
and
us have to go much slower. Well, how is that? I don't discriminate against cartoons.
Okay.
All right.
I'd imagine that the fuel costs there really cut into the peanut and tiny soda can budget. Snacks are not complimentary on
this. No pretzels?
The movie was just Biodome.
Yeah.
That was terrible. Bringing it back. All right. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of like an overview of and now you were asking like is supersonic.
Is there a future for supersonic?
Not a near future, I would say. I don't think there's a near future for it, mainly because the costs of operating it and maintaining it are so high, and the return on investment is so relatively low that I think it's going to be a while before we see supersonic jets on a commercial level, rolled out on a wide level. Like, we're not going to see that for several years.
A greater amount of efficiency would really be necessary to make it anywhere near worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, if you were looking at the numbers with the Concorde program, it looked at least on paper that it was profitable, and maybe it was, and there were other issues that caused the program to be shelved. But it's such an expensive thing to even ramp up. And then you have to have the clientele there, because obviously if it's expensive to maintain, then you have to offset that cost through the cost of the ticket.
Right. It sounds less profitable than applying some of those efficiencies to larger passenger jet engines.
Right. Especially if you can retrofit an existing fleet with with gradual improvements and then increase your efficiency that way, that would might make way more sense than building out a new fleet of aircraft that are super fast but are not efficient. So I wish I could say that supersonic commercial jets are right around the corner and soon we're going to be getting to, around the world in no time flat, but I just don't think it's there. Maybe in the far future, but not the near future. Joe,
okay.
You're giving me sad face.
Well, no. Actually, no, I feel pretty good. I feel frustrated by a lot of the practical obstacles,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I feel excited about the ideas we've just talked about.
Well, and and the thing is that all the ideas we've talked about, all the ideas we talked about are ultimately not only great for improving things like energy efficiency and the environmental impact. Ultimately, they also are financially attractive to mm-hmm. airlines. So it's not like airlines are necessarily going to drag their feet on making changes to their aircraft, because if it means that they end up saving money through operational costs, then that's better for the bottom line. So it's one of those things where these are in alignment, that's great. That's fantastic when that happens, because we see one of the problems we see with alternative energy is that often the alternatives are more expensive than what we're using right now, whether that's because they're just
harder initially.
To get at initially
certainly.
Well, also you have subsidies that end up offsetting things too, but that's one of those issues, right?
You look at that. It frequently becomes a goodness of the company's heart kind
right.
of issue rather than, and if you can make it profitable, then obviously it's a lot easier for someone to want to adopt.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, it looks like that's one of those, things are coming into alignment. So I think we will see changes over the next couple of decades. But, this is a huge industry we're talking about. So rapid change is probably something we're not going to see. I would say it'd be gradual, but, I'm hoping it will be positive change.
Yeah. No, but all this is cool. I'm excited.
Me too. All right. So we're going to wrap up this discussion, guys. Thank you for listening. If you want to join in on the discussion, I recommend you first check out our website, fwthinking.com, because it's awesome. We have blog posts, podcasts, videos up there. Go check that out. And of course, you can join in on with us talking about this. We're on Google+. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Just look for FW Thinking. You can find us at all those locations, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.